England There, England by A.G. MacDonald. Adapted in six parts by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips. Episode 5.
After the excitement of his trip to Geneva, life back in the bedsit seemed rather flat to our young Scottish friend Donald Cameron. London was formal, solid, relentlessly matter-of-fact. No one seemed to enjoy themselves, and the sun never shone. With the autumn of 1927 drawing nigh, the great English sporting public had settled down to the contemplation of professional football. Vast crowds poured down the King's Road every Saturday afternoon to see the matches at the Craven Bridge ground, and one week Donald was among them. He went partly to gather material for his book about the typical Englishman, and partly because a famous fellow countryman was due to visit the Walham Green Wanderers on behalf of West Riding United. Returning home to Royal Avenue around 6, he found the landlady's daughter, Gladys with a silent W, in a state of some distress.
Oh, Mr. Cameron, Donald, what am I to do?
What's wrong? What's happened?
He said he was from the Gaslight and Coke Company.
Who did?
The man from the Gaslight and Coke Company. Except he wasn't.
Wasn't what?
From the Oh, do pay attention. I'm trying to tell you my tale of distress.
Sorry.
Oh, very nice curly brown hair he had. But then, don't they always?
Oh, yes.
Naturally, I let him in, showed him the cupboard under the stairs and left him to get on with it. When I came back with a nice cup of tea for him, he'd gone.
Well, don't worry. I'm sure there are lots of other nice men with curly brown
hair. You're not listening, Donald. He'd gone, so I'd have my dresses, both pairs of boots, three airbrushes and an antimacassar, my mom's favourite.
Oh, well, we must call the police.
I called the police, didn't I?
Ah.
Fat lot of good. Four of them were in this street at the time and they all missed him.
What were they doing?
One was directing traffic, two were trying to show this French bloke in a bath chair the way to cross the road, and the fourth one was tying up a pram.
Oh.
By the time they got here, he'd gone. Oh, Donald.
Mm-hmm.
He used me and discarded me.
Oh, there now. You're not to blame.
I am. I should never trust men. Look at my fiancé. Going to marry me, he was. Then off he goes to Jutland and I never see him again.
But wasn't he killed?
Yes. I never could rely on him. Anyway, where have you been till this time? Up to no good, I shouldn't wonder.
Oh, just to the football, down at Walham Green. Jock Thompson was playing.
Oh, one of your Scotch cronies, eh?
No, Jock Thompson. You must have heard of him. He's the Scottish international centre-forward. He's been captain of West Riding United for 7 years.
Oh, yes. Worth the trip, was he?
I should say. He scored 3 times.
I had heard that Walham Green goalie was rubbish.
No, Jock was playing for Walham Green. Oh. He signed for them at 5 to 3 this afternoon.
Oh, just like a man. You lot can't be trusted.
Donald's main distraction during this period of stagnation was theatre-going on behalf of the London Weekly. Mr. Hodge, its cricket-loving editor, was temporarily lacking the services of his drama critic, Mr. Rupert Harcourt, who had had a fit of artistic tantrums, thrown a raw tomato at Mr. Hodge, and departed in a temper to Capri.
I bear him no malice, Donald. Poets will be poets. Besides, I knew he'd miss me.
When he went off to Capri?
No, when he threw the tomato. Anyway, how's your theatre?
Well, I have to be honest, Mr. Hodge. Before the war, the nearest thing to proper drama I saw was when the Doyley Cart played Aberdeen. Since then, well, just the odd light comedy.
Well, nothing wrong with that. It'll make a change from Harcourt's long love affair with Pirandello. Here I have to print one more crit of 6 characters in search of an author. I'll be throwing tomatoes at him.
This was a reference to Mr. Harcourt's penchant for reviewing the work of the so-called Sunday-producing societies. They existed to put on single performances of plays so outstandingly brilliant that no West End management would touch them. In 9 years since the war ended, 28 of these Sunday-producing societies have been formed, no fewer than 23 of which has started their career with 6 characters in search of an author. He didn't dare admit it to Mr. Hodge, but Donald was especially looking forward to attending a Sunday performance. He was quite ready to put up with any number of commercial adulteries, murders, and dance routines in the week for the sake of one work of genius at the end of it. The piece in question was the adaptation of a German verse play by Herr Rumpelstiltskin, set in a salt mine in Upper Silesia. It was called simply The Perpetuation of Eternity. The producer was Herr von Pumpernickel, and the incidental choreography was by someone called Drip. Ensconced in the stalls, Donald was just wondering what part choreography played in life in the Upper Silesian salt mines, when a gong struck somewhere in the theatre and the lights went out. A pause for 7 or 8 minutes followed, then the curtain rose. But had it not been for the noise it made, no one would actually have known that the curtain had risen, for the first 20 minutes of the play was conducted in total darkness. This period was occupied by a soliloquy by the spirit of Polish maternity, which fortunately had been translated. Unfortunately for Donald, it had been translated into Italian. At the end of the soliloquy, light began to flood the stage alternately with purple and green, picking out the backs of a row of salt workers who dug and chanted dismally. Then the foreman entered and shot 2 of the workers. But it was not made clear whether this was for bad digging or dismal chanting. Donald was just about to scribble a note to this effect when the lights all went out again, except for an illuminated screen upon which was thrown a picture of New York skyscrapers as observed from a Zeppelin. Then the Chrysler Building and its neighbours vanished, to be replaced by a scene from the Oberammergau Passion Play with live musical accompaniment from the Wings. Suddenly, the curtain came down, but Donald waited until applause had broken out before clapping himself, in case it was either a mistake or the type of show at which one simply didn't.
My God, and that was just the first act?
Yes, the other 4 were much the same.
Mm. And where did Herr Drip's choreography come in?
Hard to say, but I think he might have staged the bit where a salt digger's mistress acts out the kind of life she would have led if only she'd been a champion tricyclist.
Well, I did try to warn you.
I know, and I was so looking forward to seeing a proper grown-up play.
Better stick to Edgar Wallace in future. Blue lights and blackmailers.
Bill, my dear old blue pencil wielder. And Donald, what a surprise. My God, you do look quite you English.
Yes, Rupert. It could have something to do with not taking holidays in Capri.
More fools you, I say. Do you know, in the last week I've been through 500 litres of white wine and a 2-piece bathing suit.
Meantime, Donald's been through hell in the name of art.
Oh, you poor boy. He didn't make you go and see that eternal perpetuity bilge.
Actually, I volunteered.
Oh, well, I'm back now, so there'll be no need for any more of this obscure nonsense.
Oh, Rupert, I think this holiday may have done you good.
Of course it has, Bill. Now, I thought I might review this new production of 6 Characters in Search of a...
Mr. Harcourt was welcomed back into the bosom the London Weekly, and no more was said about the raw tomato. Mr. Hodge didn't neglect Donald. In fact, he swiftly moved the boy onto book reviews, sending him copies of everything from Is the Soul Immortal to Some Notes on Surrey Rock Gardens, and expecting a mere 1,000 words on each by the following Friday. His reviews weren't flashy or full of epigrams, but they satisfied Mr. Hodge's main editorial criteria. They arrived on time. A As autumn became winter, Donald had a splendid opportunity of studying the way in which the Englishman sets about his home politics. For the government of the day, having been defeated on a proposal to include raisins in a subsection of the Retail Prices Control Bill, decided to treat this as a vote of no confidence, dissolved Parliament and went to the country. The opposition gave a monstrous whoop of official joy, but were secretly furious because they'd never meant to defeat the government and weren't ready for an election. Donald was just wondering which way to turn on this issue when he got a letter from his old Geneva chief, Sir Henry Wotton, asking him to come and help defeat a young socialist in East Anglia.
Cameron, splendid to see you again.
Hello, Sir Henry.
I have to dash campaign trail and whatnot, but this is Commander Blinker, my agent. He'll fill you in.
How do you do, sir?
Join for duty, eh? Tip top. We want everyone we can get over to down these damned reds. Now, what about a spot of talky-talky platform stuff? You know, thumping the old soapbox.
Well, I'll do anything you like.
Good. First-class bundobust. We'll put you up tomorrow at the ironworks at Diffin time. I've got the hang of our dope.
Dope? I've got the leaflets here.
Oh, don't worry about them. You don't need facts or any of that, Tommy Rot. Just stick to our three planks. One, the Empire, first, last and always. Two, down with the Reds. Three, work for the unemployed.
Is there any stuff about how we're going to find work for the unemployed?
By backing up the Empire, of course. That and the abolition of the dole. Now, I must vamoose. Are you berthing down here?
Apparently.
Good. I'll give you your sailing orders tomorrow. Pip, pip, pip.
Pip, pip.
That evening, his duties having not yet begun, Donald attended a Conservative meeting in the Eldenborough Corn Exchange.
If I may have your attention, please. Thank you. Now, I'd like to start the proceedings by pointing out that the first duty of the chair is to stand up, shut up and sit down. However, there are one or two things I do want to say, briefly, of course. After all, brevity is the soul of wit, and if I fail to be brief, much of our fine candidate's valuable time will be wasted, and I think we all know what a busy man he is.
Eventually, the chairwoman got down to the main body of her brief introductory remarks and told a story about an Irishman whom she happened to know personally, a story which she thought was a very good illustration of the sterling merits of the Tory party and of the affection it inspired in all sections of the British public. 20 minutes later, she introduced the candidate.
In order not to detain you any further, I shall be very brief and simply introduce the old and trusted member for Eldenborough and District, Sir Henry Wotton.
He's a darker
Thank you. Well, I too shall be brief, for you know my views. The Empire first, last and always.
Flag.
May it never flag.
No, the flag.
Yes, and the dear old flag. I shall not rest until we see the abolition of the dole, which is sapping our British manhood, for I am in favour of work for all, and free trade be damned.
No, we need the free trade vote.
And free trade be damned if I'll hear a word against it. Thank you.
Donald was in an agony of nervous apprehension on Sir Henry's behalf. Never had he heard a speech that so pathetically begged to be torn to shreds of ridicule by hecklers.
Any questions from the floor?
The humiliation was about to start.
Madam Chairman, when the candidate says he's in favour of work for all, how does he propose to provide it?
I'm very glad that this question has been asked. Our policy, roughly speaking, is to see that jobs and adequately paid jobs are provided at once for everyone.
Oh, good God, they'll start throwing things.
Thank you very much.
What?
Madam Chairman, I should like to know what the candidate's policy is about housing.
I am very glad that this question has been asked. Our policy, roughly speaking, is to get the maximum number of houses built at the minimum cost in the shortest possible time.
Well, if there's no more questions, I'd just like, briefly, to propose a vote of thanks. I'd like, first of all, to thank the village...
Donald walked out of the hall in a dream, began to drift aimlessly through the unknown streets until he came upon a large building whose doors bore enormous posters stating in letters of scarlet fire, Ernest Dodds here tonight. Ernie for Edinburgh. Donald went in, just as the chairwoman was rising to address the meeting.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I know you've not come tonight to listen to me, so I'm going to say nothing at all. Except to say that I'd like to tell you a little story which illustrates the criminal proclivities of the Tory party and the level of contempt with which it's regarded throughout this land. Now, a personal friend of mine, an Irishman...
She then proceeded to recount the anecdote which Donald had already heard that evening and which had also appeared in that week's edition of Punch. 20 minutes later...
And so, without further ado, I'd like to call upon the Labour candidate, Mr. Ernest Dodds, to say a few words. Step up.
Friends, friends, if there were no rich, there would be no poor. If all the money was taken away from everyone, then we'd all have £317 a year. I have the figures to prove it. If dividends were forbidden, industry would be saved. I propose the limitation of incomes to £400 a year, the raising of unemployment benefit to £4 a week, and the abolition of beer tax.
Again, it seemed impossible to Donald that this candidate should escape being torn to bits by hecklers. But again, only two questions were asked.
Where will you put the money above 400 a year that you take from the rich?
Into the pockets of the poor!
Where will you get the money to pay for the raising of the dole?
Out of the pockets of the rich!
Thank you!
After these meetings, Don realised there was something to be said for the commander's dismissal of facts or any of that tommy rot. So he confined himself on the soapbox to simple eloquence about the empire and the flag. On polling day, the returning officer announced the crowd of some 10,000 citizens.
Mr. Ernest Dodds, 21,043 votes. Sir Henry Wotton, 21,043 votes.
The candidates shook hands, thanked the returning officer, and both claimed the result as an overwhelming victory. Donald found it very difficult to decide how to spend Christmas. He had no relations to visit, and he didn't like to thrust himself on any of the friends who'd been so kind to him during the months he'd spent in England. One day, he saw the solution in the window of a Haymarket travel bureau.
Hull to Danzig by steamship. £10 for 7 days.
Impulsively, he went in and bought a ticket. And at 5 o'clock on a drizzly, foggy winter's afternoon, he found himself, with spirits sinking rapidly, in the gloomy city of Kingston upon Hull. The ship itself sunk his spirits even further. It was small, dirty, and very old. And Donald was going to spend 3 days and nights in this rusty hen coop on a wintry North Sea. The crew was Polish, the officers Russian, apart from the German wireless operator, and there was to be only one other passenger.
Come along now, Stanislaus, or whatever your name is. Careful with that cargo. It's a very delicate piece of machinery. If they're pumping out sewers, you know...
Donald saw nothing of his fellow traveller until lunchtime the following day, when he did appear, spruced up to the nines in a smart grey suit and a stiff collar. It was hard to believe he was the same man who, a day earlier, had been a grime-encrusted figure in charge of a sewer pump.
I'm real glad to meet you, mister.
How do you do? My name's
Rhodes, but I'm mostly called William, or Will, or Bill, but mostly William. I'm taking a machine to Warsaw, you know.
Yes, I saw it. Isn't it
for
pumping
out sewers? Lovely it is. It'll pump out a 5,000-gallon sewer in 85 seconds, all by steam vacuum. Mm. I drove it down from Leeds yesterday. First time it's ever been on the road. Is that omelette all right, mister?
Oh, yes, very
Have
nice.
Have you ever been to Hungary?
No, but I've got a friend out there who
says... What's it like right well to hear about him? I went to Hungary once with a machine for weeding between rows of fruit trees. Stayed 2 years. Queer, isn't it?
Yes.
Fine chaps, those Hungarians, but they were terrible troubled with weeds.
Really? Anyway, this friend I mentioned, he's got a castle in Transylvania.
Oh, just 1 minute, mister. I want very much to hear about your friend, but before we get on to him, Transylvania's in Romania, isn't it?
Yes, by the Treaty of Trianon.
I was in Romania before the war. I was teaching them how to use machines for oil boring. Queer folk, the Romanians. Mm-hmm. I was there nearly 3 years. I got to like them quite a lot after a bit. Queer, isn't it?
Very queer.
Russia now. That is a queer place.
Donald escaped as soon as possible to the top deck with a book. He saw no more of William till the evening. After long hours of his own company, the unvarying oiliness of the sea and nothing to look at except the occasional passing timber ship, he was amazed to find himself almost looking forward to the Yorkshireman's company. This time, William began to talk, even before he sat down.
Have you ever travelled in Spain? It's a very queer country. Bone lazy, that's the trouble. I spent 8 months in Spain some years ago, digging irrigation canals. At least I had to do the digging in the end. That wasn't what I went out for originally. But you see what it's like there. And I never had a job of work to do in France in all my life, but I tell you what, Demerara's a queer place. Rum's cheaper than water in Demerara. Have you ever drunk rum?
Oh, during the war, I had quite a lot.
I can tell you a funny thing about Demerara rum.
Most of ours came from Jamaica.
I was in Demerara, ploughing drainage ways for getting water out of canals, when I hit in a lovely notion. I made a special carburetor that would take rum instead of petrol. Mm. What do you think of that? And before I left that, I built them a light railway, plumb through a greenwood savannah too. I don't know if you've ever built a light railway through a greenwood savannah, mister.
Not so far, no.
Well, first of all, I'd made them this machine for uprooting the trees. Then I went to them and I said...
Next morning, the good ship, we'll know, chugged doggedly up the Elbe towards the Kiel Canal. But 10 miles from Kiel, she slowed up. And there was a great running to and fro among the officers and much frenzied talk. William Rhodes excitedly told Donald that something must be wrong with some fearfully technical piece of apparatus that he inevitably knew all about. After a while, his expert diagnosis was confirmed by the wireless operator, who had identified the problem only after tearing himself away from the radio's coverage of a boxing match in Berlin. William darted off to fetch his overalls, then spent the next 4 hours on his back in the engine room, welding and riveting until, to the vast admiration of the Polish engineers, the SS Wilno resumed its normal speed. On the third afternoon, the great towers of the Marienkirche rose above the waters of the Bay of Danzig. William pointed them out to Donald.
Another journey over. I'm getting too old for journeys. 35 years I've been travelling the world, and the only place I want to see is Leeds. They were different when I was younger. Take my advice, mister, and travel while you're young.
But couldn't you ask the firm to let you stay at home?
You what? I've got 2 sons. Can't afford to give up all this foreign pay. Maybe when they're settled, I'll chuck the travelling.
And chuck the engineering too?
Oh, nay, lad. I'm a craftsman, as good as any in the north. Besides, there's poetry in machines. That's how I see it. Some folks like books and music and stuff, but I get it all out of machines. I take a lot of steel and put it in different shapes, and it works. It works. Mm-hmm. I'll go on making machines till my dying day, even if it's only toy engines for the grandchildren.
There now, that's a relief.
I didn't think we'd round that boy.
Why not?
Didn't you know? The skipper's a drunkard.
What?
Oh, yeah. He can never see where he's going. But the ship's done this trip so often, she usually finds her own way.
More bells clanged. The first officer ran up to the bridge. The engines slowed, then reversed, and the good ship Will Know managed to slip round the right side of the buoy. The ancient city of Danzig came steadily towards them. The voyage was at an end. Donald felt he was parting from a lifelong friend when he shook hands on the quay with William. He also felt that on that rusty Polish hen coop, he'd learnt a great deal about England. Next time, Donald visits Sir Henry Wotton's sister in a rustic Aylesbury farmhouse.
Mind your head on the beam.
Ah! And an elegant soiree at the Josephine Roof Garden is disrupted by the word...
Fire!
Join us then.
Part 5 of England, There, England by A.G. MacDonald was adapted by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips. With Sam Graham as Donald Cameron, Christopher Benjamin as Sir Henry Wotton, Denise Coffey as the chairwoman, Peter Kelly as Rhodes, and Katie Odie as Gladys. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Graham Harper, Kevin Oliver, and Chaz Hamilton. The director was Neil Cargill. England, There, England is a Splice of Life production for BBC Radio 2.